his mother. If John could run away right now, he would too. You think he's at the soccer fields again? Matt was done tying his shoes. He stood and looked vacantly out of the bedroom window. Part of me wants to put out a saucer of milk and wait for him to come home on his own. I know he's running away, so we'll have to find him. Well, at least part of his running away is so we'll come find him. John swung his feet off the side of the bed, taking the spot left by his son. John was fully dressed except for socks and shoes. Searching for Craig was an almost every morning event. He was prepared. Is that what you want to do? It's not like it's cold or raining outside. We could let him run around on his own for a day. I doubt he's swimming in the river or skateboarding off roofs. Matt was as exasperated as his father. John paused. We can't. If he gets hurt, well, we've lost enough. He wants to get rescued. It's the least we can do. It's the least I can do. Craig ran away for different reasons each time. If he slipped out daily, John really would tie him down or deadbolt his windows and door. But Craig might go a week without leaving, or just a day. Matt and John were caught off guard this morning. They spent the previous day hunting him down. That usually meant a few days' reprieve. He never goes to the same place right away. I have an idea. John slipped on his second shoe and stood next to his son. In the few months since Sharon's death, the line between father and oldest son had blurred. Let's take a car and head over to Highway 17. I have a feeling yesterday was a smokescreen. He's off to find Greg again, and wanted us to spend the day looking in town spinning our wheels. John walked out of the room. Matt followed, shaking his head.
I wish I could figure him out.
Help him out, Matt replied. In a way, I appreciate the diversion. If I'm thinking about him, looking for him, I'm not thinking about the shitstorm our lives have become. John grabbed a granola bar and bottle of water from the counter as he walked out the door to their garage.
I hope he's on the road. I'm tired of walking into homes with dead people.
Matt's body gave a shiver. They drove in silence, eating their breakfasts. Their taste in music was so drastic, each preferred silence to the other's CD choices.
We need a purpose, John finally said. A 10-year-old has to be kept busy. Be given a reason not to ride his bike off into the night.
Matt did not respond. He chewed his breakfast. We need a new house, and we need to get him fishing. He needs to be able to walk down to a pier and throw a line into the water, or maybe have one of us take him out into the bay.
John already contemplated a move to the bay as the days shortened.
We can pick any house we want. Let's find one that doesn't hold all of our memories. Let's find a new neighborhood that won't remind us of your mother or our friends.
John drove slowly through the empty streets of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina.
So it's done.
This is it, Matt replied flatly.
We're all that's left.
You think the city is dead?
John let the truck slow to a stop before turning to look at his son.
Let's find your little brother and start a new life. I'm not saying it's the life either of us wants, but it's the one we get until we leave for New Hampshire.
This is it, Matt. The world lost. I'm sorry to have to tell you, but yes, it's over.
He took his foot off the brake, and the car ambled north on Highway 17. John and Matt searched for a young boy riding a bike.
14. Greg woke when he heard a log tossed on the fire. The sun was not up, but he could tell it was morning.
She was real. He met a girl the night before, and ate hot food, and was on a couch in front of a fire, and he could talk to someone.
Well, if he could get a word in edgewise, he could talk to someone. Greg lay motionless to make sure Rebecca was still friendly and okay with the idea of him being there. He looked around the room. His excitement and exhaustion the previous night prevented him from noticing how neat and organized the living room was. Rebecca had a brown leather couch of her own that faced the fire. On each end of her sofa were tables with lanterns. A small table and chairs rested against the wall next to the fire. A placemat led him to believe she ate her meals at the table. A silverware caddy filled with plastic forks, spoons, knives, and paper napkins sat in the middle of the table, along with salt and pepper. A stack of paper bowls and plates were on a built-in cabinet next to the fire. "This is orderly and precise for a young girl," Greg thought. "I would swear there's an adult living with her." He lifted his head and looked for signs of a second person, but there was only the one placemat on the table. "Good morning," he said, as he stretched and sat up. "It wasn't a dream. I'm really in a house with another person." Greg was positive Rebecca was happy he was there, but he still felt out the situation to make sure. "That couch was a little more comfortable than sleeping under my dorm bed at Hightower, or bunking on the floor of a general store. Thank you for everything. The soup, the couch." "You're not leaving, are you?" Rebecca asked. "You're thanking me, as if you're going to leave in a minute. Can you stay for a little while? I have a few more surprises, a few secrets I didn't tell you last night. You fell asleep quickly. I was so excited for another person, I didn't sleep at all. Plus, all I do is sleep. It's boring being alone. I do my chores, get firewood, keep things clean, then sleep away as much time as I can." Greg smiled. He liked Rebecca. She was like the girls at Hightower, excited about life, excited about talking, and excited to tell you everything about themselves. She was a little bit different, too. He could not put his finger on it yet, but she was special. He missed people, and he particularly missed people like Rebecca, girls who liked to talk. Greg was shy. He kept his feelings and motives to himself. Finding a yin to his yang was perfect. If he had stumbled upon a person similar to himself, neither one of them would have spoken. "I want to get up to Hanover, but I'm not leaving now. Besides," he pointed to the window out the front door, "it's raining. I'm not going to start off in the rain on a 2-week hike." "Oh, yeah, no, I guess not. Well, let me show you one of the lucky things I have." She pointed to the flannel robe she gave Greg the night before. "And maybe we can get you a bath later, 'cause, well, you know, you still smell." Greg did know. He was excited to get the grime off of his body and do it using hot water. He stood up, slipped on the scuffs Rebecca set out for him, and followed her through an archway to a kitchen. They went out a back door into a yard where a large chicken coop sat with live chickens strutting about. Rebecca opened the back of the coop and pulled out 7 eggs. Greg did not count, but guessed she had at least a dozen chickens. "Urban farmers. Can you believe it? One of our neighbors had this coop and 3 chickens. Once I knew I was going to live here, I moved it. It took me 2 days to dismantle and put back together, but so much easier than walking all the way over to the neighbor's every morning for eggs. Then I found another house with chickens. Let's just say I eat a lot of eggs. Did you know they lay 1 every day?" Greg realized he had to use the bathroom. "Just a second, let me use the restroom." "Eggs," he thought to himself. "That's not out of a can or a wrapper." He used the bathroom, flushed a toilet for the first time in a week, and walked back into the cold kitchen. "The rest of the house gets really cold, colder every morning. I don't know what I can do. The living room is getting more difficult to keep warm. It's losing too much heat, and it's too large to warm from the single fireplace. I'm thinking of hanging up plastic strips, like you see in a meat locker, or maybe just 2 blankets in each entry. We could walk through the slit in the middle. We could keep most of the warmth where we need it. I know a barn a little ways from here. We could get some heavy wool horse blankets." Rebecca cracked the eggs into a nonstick pan. "I hope scrambled is okay. I crack right into the pan. Saves me a bowl to clean.
I use a plastic fork to scramble them. She threw some salt and pepper in the eggs and whisked as she walked into the other room. She set the pan down and moved a wire cooking rack over the fire. It was cast iron and allowed her to put the egg pan right over the flame.
"Another one of my dad's fireplace cooking toys," she said with a smile.
"I would eat them raw. I've been living on franks and beans, power bars, and green beans for 2 months. Actual food is going to taste fantastic."
"You said you were eating cat food." Rebecca frowned.
"I said I almost ate cat food. That's different. I never ate the cat food. It's in my backpack."
"Can you get 2 paper plates and forks from over there? These cook quickly. I can't leave them even for a second.
I usually just eat out of the pan. Saves room in the trash cans, but that's gross with 2 of us."
Greg retrieved the plates. Rebecca spooned the eggs out equally. They sat at her small table and ate breakfast. Greg noticed she put a second placemat out for him while he was in the bathroom. Rebecca smiled and stared at Greg. She finally spoke.
"Did you get as lonely as I did? I was starting to go a little insane."
"I talked to myself. Not in a crazy way, like it was a conversation, but just to hear a voice. That helped. But in the end, yes, I was lonely." Greg ate his eggs in less than a minute.
"Do you mind if I cook something else? I'm still hungry. I'm sure I can find a house with food in this subdivision."
She smiled.
"I don't think you realize how much food I have."
Greg was intrigued by her comment and sly expression, but he was hungrier than interested.
"How about this?" she told him. "I'll make you some soup, and you take a bath so I can focus on the conversation instead of your smell. I will warn you, the bathroom is cold, so while the water will be warm, you're basically taking a bath in cold air." She went to her cupboard.
"Fair enough. I'll get clean."
Greg could tell Rebecca enjoyed a plan. She kept her house spotless so rats and bugs did not come in. She kept her clothes and sheets clean to keep her humanity. He had a feeling she would go to Hanover, if he could show her it was the correct strategy. He had to convince her that leaving a food supply and a safe, warm house made sense.
Greg ate the soup while 4 pots of water warmed over the fire. He filled half the tub with the cold water from the tap and enjoyed his first hot cleaning in 2 months. If he closed his eyes, it was almost as if the rapture had not happened. He had a full belly, a warm bath, a friend. He opened his eyes, looked at the disgusting gray water around him, and pulled the plug. He wrapped in a towel and bathrobe before putting on clean clothes placed neatly outside the door. Greg was ready for the day.
"You're even cuter when you're clean," Rebecca told him, blushing as she said it.
"Okay, what do we need to do for the day? Do we need firewood? Do we need to feed the chickens? What chores do you normally do alone that I can help out with? Do you want to walk to that barn and get those blankets?"
Helping her was the best way to steer the conversation away from being called cute.
"It stopped raining. I have 2 bikes. Let's go over to the barn and get the blankets. I can show you some other stuff, too. I have a few winter coats. One should fit you.
They have hoods, and will keep any rain off if it starts up again. I washed your clothes, including your jacket. I was bored after you went to sleep. They're hanging up to dry. I have a bike helmet, if you want it."
Greg found a black jacket in the coat closet that cost $500 before the rapture. The tags were still attached to the sleeve. He slipped it on and followed her back into the kitchen and through a door that led to the garage. There were 8 bikes in the garage, 4 mountain and 4 road bikes, high-end bikes in different sizes.
"I collected things, in case people showed up," Rebecca explained.
"It cut through the boredom, gave me something to do, and gave me hope."
It was a 2-car garage. In the far bay was an SUV hybrid, which looked new. In the closer bay, next to the bikes, was just about everything Greg could imagine. Snow shovels, clothes,
jackets, gloves, tents, sleeping bags, sleeping pads, propane tanks, kettle grills, coolers, and camping gear upon camping gear. There were rain barrels and seed racks taken right from the stores. She had stacks of food, soups, noodles, flour, sugar, bottled water, energy drinks, enough to keep herself alive for years. Greg grabbed an expensive mountain bike and helmet. He followed Rebecca to the side door of the garage. The rain stopped, but it was cold and damp outside. They saw their breath as they rode down the street. Greg stayed next to Rebecca.
"Where did you get all that stuff?" he asked her.
"The Concord Mall is about 10 miles away. I used to drive my dad's delivery truck sometimes, just a few blocks, back when there was a world. I know how to drive. I took the delivery van and shopped for things. The government was not focused on a single truck driving around Concord, New Hampshire. I went through people's houses, mainly their basements and garages." She turned and gave him the look that meant she stayed away from bedrooms with dead bodies.
"I have a lot of stuff in the house, mostly in the garage and on the second floor. I keep additional canned goods in the basement. I don't like clutter. I space supplies out to make them accessible, but also so I won't be climbing over things."
She rode at a leisurely pace, making it easy to talk during their ride.
"I know what you're thinking. I don't act like I'm 13 years old."
That was exactly what Greg was thinking.
"It was just me and my parents. They owned the grocery store. They used me for a lot of errands, stocking shelves, running the register, cleaning. I did just about everything to help them out. I like to work and learn. It's hard for me to stay still. They made me do volleyball at school so I would interact with kids, rather than come straight home and work at the store. When the world ended, well, I focused on getting stuff I might need, as well as what people who found me might need, too."
She turned left onto a country road.
"Here's the barn up ahead."
Greg listened. "I didn't think you were too young to do all this stuff. We've both probably grown up a lot in the last few months. I lost my mother, some of my cousins, my aunts, my grandparents. You don't go through that kind of loss without getting stronger. I'm 14, a sophomore in high school. I should be going to football games and dances. Instead, I'm in Concord, New Hampshire, riding a bike in the rain, getting horse blankets to keep one room in a model home warm enough to stay alive." He shook his head. "We've both grown up. I think you figured it out a lot faster than I did, which is why I asked. I would still be in my dorm room eating beans, playing spy, sleeping under my bunk if I didn't have a purpose. If I didn't want to find other people. And my family." They were in front of the barn. Greg began to cry again. He did not realize how lonely and sad he was, how much he missed his mother, how much the idea of never seeing any of his friends weighed on him. He did not realize how much he missed his old life. He was living in the moment every second since the phone call with his father, since the world became sick. He was too busy staying alive to grieve.
"Why did this happen?" Greg said through his tears. "Why did I live? Why am I alone, so far from my family?"
He sobbed like a child, sucking in his breath, sniffing his nose. His shoulders bounced as he wept. Rebecca stood over her bike, watching him cry. She laid it down on the ground, went over to him, and gave him a hug. He hugged her back. The night before, when she hugged him, he put his arms around her, but he had not been hugging her. It was a polite response. Now he hugged her, held her tightly, like a lifeline or a life jacket that was keeping him afloat.
"I miss my mom so much," he said to her. "I miss my whole family."
"I miss my parents too," she replied, gripping him tightly. "But no matter what, it looks like we have each other now. Two has to be easier than one. Greg Dixon from Hightower."
She paused. "Our new name
is officially Greg and Rebecca. We are going to get through this together. She pulled back from their hug and smiled, giving a little bit of a giggle. I'm not saying this isn't going to be hard, but it has to be easier together. It has to. She took tissues from her pocket and gave him a few. Seriously, he said, still sobbing. Why do you have all this stuff? Tissues. The world ends and you keep tissues in your pocket? He laughed. Rebecca was a girl with a plan. I always keep tissues in my pocket. You'll see. I'll start to rub off on you, and you'll be more prepared. She flashed a smile and walked towards the barn. The teeny bopper girl from last night was gone. Greg realized the frenetic questioning and apparent helplessness was an act. The real Rebecca, the girl who kept a spotless house and tissues in her pocket, was no teeny bopper. This new girl acted like an adult trapped in a teen's body. Rebecca approached a side door with a slide bolt lock at the bottom. A latch door handle, a long piece of metal slipped into a notch, kept the door shut. Rebecca undid the bottom bolts, opened the door, and went inside. A second later, her head popped back out the door. Are you coming or what? It smelled like rotting hay inside. Greg did not like it, but he followed Rebecca over to a set of lockers next to the horse stalls. I let the horses go 2 weeks after the town got sick. No one could feed or tend to them. I thought they might be better out in the wild. I don't know if that's true, but if they stayed here, well, they were going to starve. She opened one of the locker doors. It was empty. She continued opening lockers until she found blankets. Here we go. She grabbed an armful. Well, come on. Let's get back before it starts to rain again. These smell fine now, but wet wool blankets? I won't hang those in the house. So, if you can drive, Greg started, why didn't we bring the truck over here? Why did I have to ride a bike in the cold and now balance blankets on my handlebars? Greg questioned some of the girl's story. I have no idea how long gas stays viable, and as far as I can tell, we have a finite amount of it. I am not wasting gas when we can ride to get blankets. Keeping yourself fit, making sure you don't just lay around the house, getting out into the fresh air, it's important. Plus, she looked at him as they got back on their bikes. I wanted to go on a bike ride with a cute boy. It's been a long time since I've done that. She started back to the house, quicker than she rode over. Greg and Rebecca, he thought to himself. I like it. She was getting ahead of him. Greg jumped on his bike and pedaled hard to catch up. 15. Paul and Hank Dixon left Dayton, Ohio the day after Paul arrived. They headed east, traveling as far as possible during the freakishly warm December. Hank's neighbor had two Honda Goldwing motorcycles with large saddle compartments. The brothers, despite their questionable motorcycle capabilities, rode the bikes out of town early that next morning. They knew motorcycle riding was more dangerous and colder than using a car, but taking two bikes meant one could break down without stranding them. Motorcycles were easier to navigate through potential roadblocks, accidents, and traffic jams. They stayed on large four-lane highways, riding along U.S. 70 the first day. The roads were clear, and they kept their speed at a constant 75 miles per hour. Paul did not have the confidence to ride faster. They stopped briefly for lunch and to siphon gas from abandoned cars. They finished their day on the north side of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The first four houses they searched had the odor of death. The fifth smelled clear. Exhausted, they ate cold beef and noodle soup from cans before climbing into their sleeping bags just after the sun went down. Paul and Hank exchanged no more than 100 words the entire day. The next morning they turned north towards Albany, New York. The clouds rolled in, and a light snow began to fall before noon. They avoided New York City and moved into the snow belt of New England. They adjusted their speed to safely navigate the dusting of powder and rolled into Rutland, Vermont in the afternoon. They were only an hour or so away from Hanover, but on the wrong side of several large mountains. It was the shortest day of the year. The sun was almost gone, and it was snowing. The snow melted as it hit the ground in New York, but Vermont's streets disappeared under a blanket of white. Riding motorcycles, dangerous before because of their novice abilities, was quickly becoming too great a risk. Hank slowed his bike to a stop. Paul pulled next to him.
"Let's stop here. I can't ride anymore. It's dark. I'm tired and hungry."
Hank was exhausted.
"We're an hour away. I think we can push through and make it."
Paul was equally tired, but wanted to get to Hanover.
"Paul," Hank yelled through the increasing loud and blowing wind. "It's snowing. We're in the mountains on motorcycles. It's pitch black. Best case, we get to Hanover in the complete dark. Let's find a place to bunk here. Stay out of this mini-storm. Get up there tomorrow. I'm beat, and we may only be 50 miles away, but in this weather, on bikes, it's going to take us 2 hours, maybe more."
Paul conceded the night. They stood over their bikes at the intersection of rural routes 4 and 7. The roads met at a T, with 4 merging into 7 with a left turn. In front of them was a concrete wall with a small hill continuing behind it. Paul looked down the street, Main Street, conveniently enough. To their right and slightly up the hill was a large white house with an enormous wraparound porch. A sign hung on metal eyelets off a white wooden signpost. Paul could not make out the wording through the falling snow.
"That has some chimneys," he pointed at the house.
"Maybe it's a B&B or an old hotel. We can get a fire going."
"Sounds good."
Hank nodded and turned his bike towards the white home. The snow was accumulating quickly. They half rode, half walked their bikes to the bottom of the hill and up the steep driveway. Their tires spun in the new snow. Hank read the sign as he walked past, the Rutland Inn. Paul and Hank pulled their bikes against the hotel in hopes the overhang would offer some protection from the snow. They walked up 3 steps onto the porch and tried the front door. It was unlocked.
"Hello?"
Paul said loudly into the pitch-black lobby. He could tell the hotel was empty. The inside temperature matched the outdoor temperature. There was no smell of decaying bodies. The white house on the hill appeared to be uninhabited and clean.
"Wow, it's really coming down now."
Hank pointed 2 flashlights towards the outside. He pulled out a box of tea candles and a lighter from his backpack and began lighting the main room of the hotel.
"I saw wood under a cover in back. You want to grab some? I'll light the room and find a fireplace."
"Got it," Paul replied.
They had been on the road for just 2 days and seldom spoke, but found they worked well together. He went back outside. It was colder than it had been just an hour ago. The snow was falling much harder.
"Hank made a good call stopping," he mumbled to himself.
Paul found the wood, grabbed an armful, and went back inside. Paul kicked open the door, and the gust of wind that followed him blew out half of Hank's tea candles. The few that remained lit cast enough light to show Hank kneeling inside a large fireplace with one arm stuck up the chimney.
"I think this is our best bet tonight. I opened the flue. We can get it going with a quick light log and your first armful of wood."
Hank and Paul packed synthetic logs in their motorcycles to start fires quickly and easily. The quick-starting logs meant not worrying about kindling or paper, and gave them an hour of steady light and fire to gather additional wood. The snow came down harder. The wind began to howl through the open front door, pushing through a cloud of frozen powder. Paul pushed the door shut.
"You know I don't like to feed your ego, but it was the right decision to stop. You may have saved us. Can you imagine getting stuck on Mount Killington in this crap? Who knows how long we would have lasted up there?"
Paul unzipped his backpack and pulled out soup, a bag of instant rice, and a liter of bottled water.
I wish I could claim intelligence, but I'm just tired. There wasn't thought put into it other than me not being able to go any further. Don't forget, I'm old.
We should move the bikes behind the hotel. They're getting pelted next to the building. The structure behind the hotel where Paul found the wood was a 4-bay carport.
Good idea. They might get snowed in where they are. Of course they'll get snowed in over there too, but at least they'll be dry, Hank agreed, sitting on the hearth and rubbing off the black ash from the flue now covering his hands. Paul went back outside. He wheeled his bike towards a bay in the carport. Firewood was stacked to the ceiling in one of the bays. The wood was dry and ready to burn.
Look at that. Nice New England people ready for the winter, Paul said to his brother, walking behind him and pushing his motorcycle.
Let's hope we don't need much of it, Hank replied as he parked his bike against the back wall. Tonight was not about settling down for the long haul. Tonight was about eating, getting warm, and sleeping with as much comfort as possible before they made the final push to Hanover. It was their third night together. They worked as a well-practiced team. Paul grabbed the quick-starting log from Hank's saddlebag and went back to the house. Hank spied a log carrier with wheels and pulled it over to the stacks of wood. He filled the roller with as many logs as he could and pulled it into the house. Paul lit the synthetic log and placed 3 wood logs on top of it to start their fire. When the fire caught, Paul searched for a kitchen to locate a pot to warm their rice and soup. The front room was bright with light from the fire and tea light candles. Hank snapped on a headlamp before he moved his bike and gathered wood. He clicked it to off when he walked into the hotel lobby with the log carrier. Paul came back into the room through a swinging door that led to the kitchen.
Are you ready for another piece of Hank Dixon luck?
Paul was grinning. There's a wood stove back there. A working wood stove. I don't want to fire it up tonight, I'm too tired. But tomorrow morning? I bet the stove will make the kitchen warm and cozy.
Now I am starting to think I'm a genius for stopping, Hank said back. He stood by the fire with his hands on his hips to take stock of the lobby.
The hotel was a converted Victorian mansion. Hank and Paul stood in the combination lobby and breakfast eating area. The good news was the room had a fireplace. The bad news was the room was large and would be difficult to heat from a single fire source. Hank eyed 2 full-length couches facing each other in front of the fireplace.
Hey, Paul, let's move these right next to the fire and facing the heat. I bet it will be just as cozy tonight as your kitchen will be tomorrow morning.
He grabbed one end of a couch. Paul grabbed the other. They faced the first couch towards the fire 2 feet from the fire screen. They moved the other couch in a similar diagonal position. The top of each couch touched in the middle 4 feet away from the fireplace, creating a V-shaped wall to trap heat. Paul pulled the tops off of 2 cans of soup, poured the contents into the pot, dumped the instant rice into the mixture, and placed the pot next to the roaring fire.
The wood is dry. It's burning well.
Hank unpacked the rolling cart, stacking the wood on the hearth.
I'm going to grab another cart of wood so we have some more inside. I want to make sure you have some to make my breakfast tomorrow morning. Do you think you can find some blankets and sheets upstairs, or do you want to use our sleeping bags?
I'm on it, Paul said, jumping up from next to the fire. I want to take my coat and boots off once. Let's get all our stuff together right now. I'll get some bowls and spoons, too.
Paul wore a headlamp similar to Hank's. He turned the headlamp on and grabbed a flashlight from his backpack. He walked to a set of stairs on the wall opposite the front door and followed them to the second floor. He did not feel like entering any rooms for fear the rooms were still occupied. He stood at the top of the stairs, pointing his flashlight down a long hallway. Brass numbers hung on several doors running down the length of the hall. Paul noticed 2 of the doors did not have numbers, and guessed correctly the doors were closets. The first closet held cleaning supplies and paper products. The second closet housed sheets and several thick polyester blankets encountered in modestly priced hotels.
Jackpot, Paul said to himself.
He walked back downstairs, dropped the linen on one of the sofas, and went into the kitchen to retrieve spoons and bowls. As he opened cupboards, he found a well-organized kitchen and an extremely well-stocked pantry.
His hunger prevented him from spending too much time admiring. He grabbed a large stirring spoon, two bowls, two soup spoons, paper towels, and headed back into the living room. As he came through the swinging door, he noticed a distinct difference in the temperature. It was cold in the kitchen, but it was close to tolerable in the living room. The fire took the chill and dampness out of the air. He put the bowls and spoons on the floor, stirred the soup in the pot, and moved the pot to the other side of the fireplace so the cooler side faced the heat. He noticed a coffee table and pulled it next to the hearth, between the couches and the fire. They could use it as a dinner table, allowing the brothers to sit on the large hearth or on the couches while they enjoyed hot soup and soaked in the warmth of the fire. Paul unzipped his jacket, untied his boots, and settled in for the night. Hank opened the front door and came in with a third cart of wood. His shoulders and hair were white with snow from the 25-yard walk to the carport. "I bet there's an inch down already, and it's snowing harder." Hank did not look happy. "You think they have early plow service? If not, we might be here until June. There's nothing we can do about it now. Let's eat, sleep, and come up with a plan, if needed, tomorrow." Paul poured potato and bacon soup into each bowl. The mixture was thick and lumpy with rice. Hank unzipped his coat, took off his boots, and walked over to the hearth. "Wow, I'm almost not cold for the first time today. That has to count for something." He looked at his bowl. "No tiny stars in my soup tonight?" He still teased his brother for serving him children's-style chicken noodle soup the first night. The two men ate in silence, letting the fire and food warm their bodies. Hank, utterly exhausted, found the bathroom, threw two more logs on the fire, and lay down on one of the couches. He pulled two of the fuzzy blankets Paul draped over the back of the couch on top of him.
"If you wake up, throw another log on the fire."
Hank yawned as he said fire. He was asleep before he finished his yawn.
"Sleep well, old man," Paul responded in a whisper.
Before he went to bed, Paul proactively built a fire in the wood stove for the next morning. He was not far behind Hank in the exhausted department. He blew out the few tea lights that remained lit and curled up under the blankets on his couch. Paul's head was inches from Hank's, separated by the arms of their couches at the top of the V formation. Paul ignored Hank's light snoring and soon fell fast asleep. Hank awoke in the dark. Embers from the fire cast flickers of light onto the ceiling and the room. Paul was asleep next to him. All was quiet and safe. He got up, threw three logs on the fire, went to the bathroom, and fell back into a deep sleep. Paul awoke and had a similar experience later in the morning. Aside from the single wake, both men slept soundly throughout the night. Hank awoke to a bright room. The sun was out, shining through a bank of windows on the dining side of the lobby. He sat up and stretched his arms. The fire was still burning. Red embers kicked off enough heat to keep the hearth area warm. The couches, faced towards the fire, collected heat throughout the night. Hank slept warmly for the first time in months. He stood to put a fresh log on the fire.
"Do we care what time it is?"
Paul said from his couch. He lay on his back and stretched his arms in front of his head, letting out a slight groan.
"I have to get up, too. I'm starving, and I have to go to the bathroom. I haven't slept that well in a long, long time. I was warm. I felt safe. I knew I couldn't go anywhere, and I wasn't in a hurry to get to the next place. That was my best night's sleep in probably 5 months, since I read about the flu in Brazil."
Hank sat on the hearth in navy long johns and a red waffle shirt.
"Yeah, I know. Even 2 nights ago in Harrisburg, I was antsy to get to Hanover. I didn't sleep well. And, well, it wasn't comfortable. This fireplace is awesome."
Paul sat up on his couch.
"I'll brave the kitchen and light the wood stove. I made it after you went to bed. Should just take a match."
He stood and went into the other room. Hank walked to the front of the house. He looked out the bank of windows.
"Holy shit,"
he said to himself. The sun was shining, but everything outside was white. There was at least a foot of snow on the ground, probably more. He and Paul were not going to Hanover today. Not on motorcycles. Paul came back through the door.
Fire is on. The kitchen will be warm soon and we'll be eating something good.
I hope we have a lot of food here, because unless we find a snowcat or wrecker with a plow, we might be here a while. I know I was joking when I said June, but, well, it might be June.
Paul was used to Hank exaggerating and being too serious.
Okay, calm down. I'm sure we'll be able to get going. Paul walked across the room to look out the window. He let out a small gasp.
Well, we do have a lot of food in the kitchen. And I mean a lot of food.
He picked up a digital thermometer on one of the windowsills in the dining area. It read 11 degrees.
Look at the temp. It dropped 40 degrees from lunch yesterday.
Paul let out a small chuckle. Hey, no school. Hank was not amused.
Where the hell are we anyway? Rutland? There has to be a tourist map or info sheet in this place. It's a hotel.
I'm going to investigate while you make breakfast. I'm sure we can find a truck to get us over the mountains to Hanover. Worst case is we're stuck here for a while. It's 11 outside, but I bet it's 60 in here, warmer on the couches. As long as we have wood, we're going to be warm and dry.
The feeling of calm and happiness Hank felt when he woke were gone, replaced by panic. He felt trapped.
Let me give you the good news, then.
Paul placed his hand on Hank's shoulder. Grab your headlamp. You have to see this kitchen.
Hank grabbed his headlamp and a flashlight and followed his brother into the kitchen. Hank had not been in the room yet. He was impressed with how nice a kitchen it was, outfitted in high-end, restaurant-grade appliances. It was immaculate, and noticeably warmer than the front room. The wood stove kept in the corner as a novelty heated the back room quickly and efficiently.
"This place is fantastic," Hank said as he looked around. Hank was an avid cook before the rapture. "I could do some damage here."
Paul's voice could be heard from behind a large open door. "That's not what I want you to see. Check out the pantry I found last night." Hank saw a metal door with a large silver handle. It looked like a walk-in freezer, but was instead a pantry large enough for a Mini Cooper or punch buggy. Hank walked to the other side of the door to inspect the storage room. Paul stood in the middle, his arms outstretched to either side to emphasize the amazing find. There was more food in the pantry than either of them could imagine. Good, canned food in perfect condition. There were vegetables, fruits, canned meats, canned fish, broths, and coffees. The pantry went from floor to ceiling, with shelves 8 feet high and 2 feet deep. There appeared to be 6 to 12 months of food.
What do you think? Were these people preppers? Did they plan for the apocalypse?
Paul picked up a can of salmon.
I bet they stocked up for the high season, made sure they had plenty of food for the winter months, maybe used their cash at the end of the previous year to stock up on things for next year. If they bought throughout the summer and kept things in here, they wouldn't have to worry about food prices or their winter cash flow as much.
I don't know. Hank picked up a light blue can, turning the label to show Paul.
Do you really think preppers would stock high-end organic broth? People prepping for the end of the world are about utility, not gourmet.
Hank was impressed with the quality of the ingredients. He was also excited to see meat and fruit. He had eaten enough soup and instant rice for a while.
Look at the pastry section. Flour, yeast, sugar. I am making bread tonight. Oh, man, I haven't had a piece of bread in 3 months.
Hank pointed at the dry goods shelves with excitement. He grabbed a box of pancake mix.
Hey, how about pancakes? Let's do pancakes.
He was as giddy as a little kid. It was a wild Maine blueberry pancake mix.
We don't have eggs, but we can do without eggs. Oh, man. Real syrup. Pancakes. Being stranded with you might not be so bad.
Hank's mood changed again. He was no longer scared and trapped. He had warmth, shelter, food, and companionship.
Okay. You're scaring me a little. Are you really that fired up about blueberry pancakes?
Paul was excited to find the food, but Hank's enthusiasm bordered on maniacal.
You're acting like you haven't eaten real food in months.
I haven't, Hank shouted back. He left the pantry in search of a bowl to mix his pancakes.
Pull out that mini solar radio thing. Let's get some music going. I want a full belly before I think about being stuck in Rutland, Vermont for the next 4 months.
Hank, having found a bowl, opened drawers looking for measuring cups. Paul tried the door next to the pantry and found steps that led to a wine cellar and additional food, including cured meats and cheeses imported from Italy and France. The Rutland Inn was a jackpot. Hank was right about the owners. Their names were Steve and Nicole. Running the B&B was their second career. They left lives in academia at the ages of 50. The inn catered to skiers in the winter and leaf peepers in the fall. Each spring they used their cash to purchase food throughout the summer months, whenever high-end items were on sale. The couple took in a few boarders in the spring and summer months, but mostly prepared for the high season of October through April. Every July and August, Steve and Nicole closed the inn and traveled to Europe. They did not make it back to the U.S. this trip, dying in a Venice hotel from the rapture one day apart. No one thought to loot a 3-star bed and breakfast on a busy street in Rutland. The inn remained untouched until Paul and Hank stumbled into the front door that December, a door left unlocked by the friend who was collecting packages, flyers, and newspapers. Rutland was a safe town. People seldom locked their doors anyway. The blueberry pancakes were Nicole's favorite brand. Hank and Paul would never know the story of the people who saved their lives in Rutland that winter. They would never know that Nicole taught psychology at Indiana University, while Steve taught English literature at the local community college. No one was alive to remember how Steve declined repeated offers to teach at several universities, believing community colleges filled an educational void when state colleges decided to compete with private universities for money and rankings. Nicole was a trained pastry chef. Steve was a triathlete. Their story was gone, like billions of other stories taken from the world in just 5 short months by a disease no one saw coming or had time to understand. Steve's favorite picture of the couple hung in the lobby, taken as they stood on the steps of a random old building in Italy. Hank and Paul sat at one of the tables in the dining area. The fire was going strong. They were comfortable in pants and long-sleeved shirts, their empty pancake plates in front of them as they looked outside at the snow.
"We're not going anywhere today," Paul said, breaking their silence. "I'm tired. Let's enjoy the day at the hotel. We have food. We're 50 miles from Hanover. I say we take a break." "I'd like a break. I've been stressed out and planning crap for months. I want a day off."
"You know what? I agree. I might research the area with the maps and guidebooks from the lobby desk, but you're right. Let's enjoy the day." Hank sipped his coffee. "When was the last time you had coffee? It's been 3 months for me. Man, I miss coffee."
"Seriously?
It's only been 3 days for me. I had coffee the morning I rode up to see you. Not all of us lived in a hole in the ground for 2 months. Actually, I lived quite nicely. I had food and music. I read books. I was lonely and bored, but I had coffee and some of the finer things in life to keep me comfortable." "Asshole. I didn't have coffee. I drank dirty water most of the time. It was purified, but it had dirt in it."
Paul stared at his brother. "I'm sorry about your family, Hank. I'm sorry I wasn't there to help."
"You lost too, Paul. We both lost everything. I won't forget. But I have to move on." He took another sip of coffee. "I cried a lot. I still hurt.
but I have to fight forward.
Yeah, I know.
Paul nodded and looked down at his feet.
So, he said, looking back up,
why exactly were you living in a hole for 2 months?
What the hell were you thinking?
Paul was dying to ask Hank the question for the last 3 days, but they never had the time to talk. Riding motorcycles tandem across the country was not conducive to long conversations. I was trying to lose weight. If I had stayed in my house like you did, I would have continued to live my unhealthy lifestyle. Think of my hole as a self-imposed eating intervention. Hank's wry smile emphasized his sarcasm. I'm all for the new trimmer, Hank, but seriously, were there government roundups in Dayton or something? Was the military patrolling? What's up? Paul did not have issues in Cincinnati. His house was off the beaten path. Hank's house was 2 blocks from a hospital, next to a school, near a highway, near stores. Hank was not downtown Washington, D.C., but his house was more conspicuous than most.
You know the golf course was my social network, right? Hank started.
Yeah, and a few work people, Paul replied.
Yeah, but work was pretty far away. When all the crap hit the fan, I was in Dayton. There were 5 of us that weren't getting sick. Panic was pretty much everywhere. Cell phones still worked. The 5 of us would keep in touch. He paused. The girls were sick. I spent my time caring for them, although, as you know, there wasn't much to do. They didn't eat anything, or hardly anything, and they weren't uncomfortable. I was more or less just spending time with them, trying to nurse them back to health, keep them alive for a cure. Enjoying my last days with them. Hank sighed. Anyway, I would keep tabs on my friends, who was sick, who was already dead, what people planned to do. Like I said, there were 5 of us that were healthy, or at least 5 of us that weren't sick yet. We were conferencing in with each other. 3 of the guys hadn't eaten in a day or so, but they didn't have fevers. They were telling us they were okay, just not hungry from all the excitement and worry. I knew they were dead. I'm sure they knew, too. But you tell yourself whatever you need to tell yourself to get up the next morning. He took another sip of coffee. So, Fritzy is one of these 5 people, and we're all on the phone together. He's talking about how he is eating. He's not sick. He's been out and about recently. Went to one of the government meetings going on every night. He asked me to go, but I stayed home with the girls. He said they had scanners you walked through when you came into the hall, checking body temps, seeing if anyone was contagious. He is literally the only person that pops a 98.6. Everyone else is 100 degrees or more. He was laughing about it to us. How funny it was. Hank set his cup down. He's on the phone, and his doorbell rings. He slips his phone into his pocket. The rest of us can hear what's happening. We hear him answering the door. I'm screaming, don't answer the door. Hide, run, don't get the door. But he ignores my screams. All we hear is him saying, yes, officers. And then we hear a scuffle, and the phone is dead. He was gone. Paul looked at his brother. You're kidding. I waited for the girls to die. I buried them. I burned the house. I was nervous about talking on the phone with all of you after Fritzy was taken, but I had to know the plan. I had to know where to go. I can't believe the government, as desperate as it was, would snatch people up like you describe. It had to be something else. I went to his house a day later, late at night, like some fat ninja dressed in black sweats. His front door was still open and his cell phone was on the ground, smashed. You believe what you want to believe, but I know what happened. I crawled into a hole I made for myself and drank muddy water for 2 months.
It was a better alternative to being grabbed by the feds.
Did you hear the stats on how many they thought would live? Paul asked. You had a radio, right? Something to stay connected?
I monitored the broadcasts a little. I tried to make my batteries last. I didn't have the radio on all the time.
They theorized that 1 out of every 1,000,000 people was immune. Some of the immunologists thought maybe no one, but finally estimated 300 people might survive in the U.S.
If the government was able to find a few of these people, I wonder if those unlucky people survived the government. How crappy would it be if your buddy was immune to the rapture, but died locked up in a government facility?
You don't have to ask me. You know my answer. I hold up. I listen to the radio every once in a while for an hour or so. When I found dead air for a few weeks in a row, I came out of my hole. I didn't bury my family in the dead of night behind my house like some criminal to end up getting prodded and poked by government doctors.
He picked up his coffee and cradled the warm mug in his hands.
You know why I think they had those meetings? Those handouts or information sessions? Hank continued. I've had 2 months to think about this stuff. So if I sound crazy, well, maybe I am a little crazy. Anyway, I think the government lost so many smart people, and the technology companies shut down so fast, the feds didn't have the capability to monitor cell phones or regular phones or email or anything. They were so short-staffed, and the people left were probably so dumb the feds had to trick people like Fritzy into outing themselves. The community meetings were a ruse, concocted to find healthy people.
Hank shook his head. Poor bastard. Who knows if Fritzy was really immune? There weren't 1,000,000 people in Dayton. If I lived, the odds both of us played golf together and were immune? Whatever. Damn feds. I didn't like them before the whole thing happened. I certainly don't like them now.
Hank finished his coffee and stood up. Look who lived, and look who died.
I win. Let's focus on the future, not the screwed-up past. What does this town have to offer? I think we need to find snowshoes and warmer jackets. Not today, but after our day off.
Hank walked over to the front desk and looked for pamphlets or a town guide. He opened the desk drawers and pulled out a Rutland Yellow Pages.
Look at this! Hank held up the floppy book for Paul to see. Internet my ass, right?
Paul laughed. Internet my ass.
Do you think we can find a couple of snowmobiles in this town? How far can a snowmobile go on a tank of gas? Can it get to Hanover?
Hank had the Yellow Pages open to S. Paul could tell this was Hank's first coffee in 2 months. His brother was wired.
If we find a dealer, I'm sure it's on the specs.
It appeared their day off was fast becoming less of a day off than Paul wanted.
16. Todd and Emily played catch with their sons in the cul-de-sac on October 1st. A football was thrown between kids and parents. They had not heard or seen another living person for months. Raleigh was dead. The government pulled out when the pandemic spread to other cities and towns. Scientists needed survivors. Raleigh did not have any that they were aware. Healthy people evacuated in July, and the residents who stayed were dead the same month. The power went off in September. Todd went on regular patrols, usually at night, sometimes during the day. He had not seen a sign of life in the last 8 weeks. He went in homes, took food, water, soft drinks, and supplies. He never saw a living soul. He did not see smoke from fires. He did not hear machinery or cars. Todd was positive he and his family were the only people alive in Raleigh. He knew for weeks, but he kept Emily and the kids safely confined to their house. The looting and rioting that plagued the rest of the U.S. was not present in Raleigh. People fled or died before panic began. Todd found provisions and helpful items at malls, supermarkets, and warehouse stores.
He acquired a solar generator and solar-powered lights. He had gas generators for cloudy days and cold evenings. He had boxes of batteries, a dozen propane tanks, and more fire.